change is inevitable and can often be chaotic. However, when it's fully organized, change can be dynamic, powerful, and progressive. The Organizing for Change podcast will help you move from a spectator to a difference maker and will assist you in bringing positive change to your community, your city, and perhaps of most importance, you. Hosted by Amanda Decker, drug-free community's substance use prevention coordinator, mom to many, entrepreneur, and fan of great conversation, Organizing for Change is heard in over 40 countries and every state in the USA. We are delighted that you've joined us today, because after all, we do this for you, and that will never change. Here's Amanda.
Welcome to episode 40 of the Organizing for Change podcast, where our goal is to equip coalitions, organizations, and individuals to bring change to their community. I appreciate all of your support. If you'd like to be an insider for the Organizing for Change podcast, be sure to join our email list. You will be the first to know about upcoming episodes, and you will get a summary after each episode with links to anything we've talked about emailed right to your inbox. Just click on the link in the notes to join our community today. My guest today is my husband, Lauren Decker. We were talking about what a challenge it is to live during these times, but how important it is to live with hope. And Lauren is no stranger to challenge, are you?
No, I consider my relationships usually the easiest thing in my world, so everything else is a challenge compared to that.
I paid him to say that. About 10 years ago, you were diagnosed with Parkinson's disease, and I see you walk through this life carrying that disease, but also carrying so much hope and living with such intentionality and purpose.
Well, you have to have hope, because if you don't, you'll collapse and give up. But hope springs eternal. It really does. And we hope for a cure. We hope for medicine that works better. We hope that I improve. But reality has been the opposite of that so far. And yet we still hope. And I want to pass on hope to other people, because I know there are many people listening who have mobility challenges or physical handicaps that hold them back. Parkinson's slows me down, but it doesn't keep me from doing what I want to do. I just go very slow as I do it, and maddeningly slow, right? But some people are confined to wheelchairs. I think of my good friend Johnny Erickson Tata. She's been in a wheelchair for 50 years, and she still resonates hope. And the human spirit is dominant. It's creative. It's powerful. It's hard to subdue. But fighting physical aspects of things every day can really do a number on you, as we've found.
I think back to the time right before you got diagnosed. We had little kids in the house, and we were driving them to school every day. It was just a chaotic time. You had a lot of responsibilities at your job as a pastor in one of the local towns nearby, and just every day we've watched as your body was just shutting down, and neither of us had any answers. I mean, I'd go on the computer and Google everything. I know you're not supposed to do that, but I would. And just, we had no answers, and it was just such a scary time. I can remember actually one of the posts on our bed broke, and we needed to lift it up in order to reattach the post. And I just remember not being physically strong enough myself, and then realizing that you weren't strong enough to lift it either. And it was just such a heartbreaking moment, because I thought to myself, you know, I had no idea what was happening. I didn't know that you had Parkinson's. You didn't know. We knew that you were slowly, you know, dying. And it was just such a scary thing to be in a place to not have answers.
Yeah, it was actually a relief to hear what we had. To put a label on it, a name to it, because you're right. I remember calling you from the side of the road and saying, I just wrecked the front end of the car. I hit a curb, and I wasn't driving well, and I would aim for the driveway but bypass it every time I came home, and my reaction time was slow and getting slower. a friend of ours who's a nurse in our congregation said to me, have you been checked for Parkinson's? And I said, no. She said, if I were you, I'd get down there and get checked right away. So we went and got checked, and then we were at a festival during the summertime that we always attend, Soul Fest, and somebody said to you, I didn't know Lauren had Parkinson's, and you said, I didn't either, but we wondered what it was. And for those two on the spot diagnoses that we had from our friends, we proceeded to go to Beth Israel Hospital and walked in, and the experts there said, you're a classic bread and butter case. Your Parkinson's Incorporated. And we had an enemy to fight then. We had a explanation, a cause to rally around. And our family did. And so Dad tips over easily, and Dad sometimes eats very slowly, but Dad can't hold a cup of coffee without having it vibrate out of his hand. But I still try to bring you coffee in the morning.
I think that's so important, though, what you just said. Like, I think part of having hope is having a name to your trouble or your trial. And I think the most complicated thing that we can do is not have facts in front of us and, you know, hypothesize about whatever it is that might be the challenge on our plate. I think that's true in relationship. I think that's true in community. I think it's so important to get a diagnosis or to get facts to be able to look at a problem so that you really can, you know, eliminate, I guess, all the other things that run through your head.
Yeah, it's difficult because you don't want to inflict Parkinson's on the people you love. And it's, you can't help it. It's a shared burden. It's something you have to take on as a family, as a congregation, as a town. It's the support has to be there. It's nothing you can face by yourself because you can't even get out of a chair by yourself sometimes. It's very mentally fatiguing to walk into a room and see where you can stand, where you won't bump into someone accidentally, or find a seat where you know you'll be able to get out of it. If you sit down on the couch, you might never get off it again. And you have to mentally weigh all these things and assess constantly and try to challenge your own body to do what is able to do. And I know that there's a rallying theme that says rise above it, but you can't rise above it. It's bigger than you. It's gigantic. It sits on your chest and laughs at you. It's there when you wake up in the morning. It's the first thing to greet you is Parkinson's. People don't know what it's like to go through that kind of thing. But I know that there are people listening who do know what it's like, and to try to convey it to others is, if I could share a story that I love. Two families were in the children's hospital in a major city, and they both had very sick children, and they were staying at the house where they allow parents to stay free while their child undergoes treatment. Sort of like the Ronald McDonald House, but earlier version of that. This was probably 50 years ago. And it was apparent as the days went by and turned into weeks that one child was getting better, but the other family's child was getting worse. And these families got very close with a special bond that only families going through the tragedy can share. And the day came when a phone call to the house was answered, and the person on the other end was from the hospital, and they said that one of the children had died. And the family had spent all their money on medical expenses and travel, and they had no resources left. And just that same day, the other family was told their child could go home. So they stood at the end of the driveway and watched as this family with a child who passed away, they couldn't afford a plane ticket for the coffin. They couldn't afford a train ride. They couldn't afford any transportation at all back to their home in the Midwest. They simply had to pack the dead child in a blanket, rolled up in a blanket, and put it in the trunk of their car, and began the long, slow drive, full of grief, back home. As they pulled out of the driveway, an impatient driver cut them off and honked and leaned on the horn, waved his fingers at them in gestures that are not kind. And the mother of the child who got well was watching them leave, waving goodbye. And when that happened, she said, if they only knew it was in the trunk of that car, they never would act that way. The burden they're carrying. And we don't know the burden people are carrying. We see them, but we don't know that they're suffering from horrific sadness over some issue or some loss. And when you deal with someone with an incurable disease, it's good to know what they're carrying. And education is very helpful. So I hope I can, by doing this show with you, educate some people to make a difference in somebody's life who's struggling. And don't become impatient with them, because that's the last thing they need. And just because they're physically slow doesn't mean they're mentally slow. I've been writing books since I came down with Parkinson's, and my creativity is way up. I don't think I ever would have written a book if it hadn't been for Parkinson's slowing me down to the speed where I could sit down and write a book. Mm. I was very active before that, but...
I think you brought up an interesting point just now, too, where you were talking about how nobody knows what is in somebody else's trunk. And I think that's why it's so important to ask questions. I tend to be the type of person, I love to read and research things. If somebody has a problem, I love to go and just read as much as I can about it. But there's nothing like the power of asking somebody a question, because at the end of the day, I can read everything there is to read on Parkinson's. I can watch the videos. I can have all the knowledge possible. But to really understand where you're at, or just understand what you're going through, it doesn't help me to rattle off a bunch of information. It really is much more helpful to you just to ask you, you know, how are you doing? And, you know, help me understand what you're going through. And it doesn't mean I totally get it either, but I think we've both noticed that it just sometimes feels good just to be heard.
You provide that for parents a lot, who have children that are dealing with substance abuse, and they're carrying that incredible pain through their lives and their hopes for their children to be well, to be whole, to be made well. But you're able to get information and turn it into compassion and then apply it to someone who needs it. And information without compassion is just words. And people have to know that you care before they care what you know.
So true. I think oftentimes it's so tempting for folks in my position, because you can see a problem in a community or you can see an issue. Sometimes the issue is not even something that can be fixed, but I think it's just natural for humans to want to help and want to fix and want to make it better. But sometimes the best thing that we can do is just be there for somebody and just say, I can't fix this. I don't have any answers. I don't even know what it's like to be you or what you're going through, but I just want you to know that I am here and I'm willing to just exist and be here in this space and do whatever it is that you need me to do, even if it means doing nothing at all, just being present.
I remember years ago, you had a friend who lost a sister in a tragic accident. And you just went and sat with the family and just didn't say a word, but sat and cried with the family. But now whenever they look back at that time, they'll know that you were there and that you could be there for them at that moment. It's a real powerful boost for someone's spirits, because they you realize someone does care. They did give up their own time to come be with us, and they didn't try to ram thoughts and ideas down our throat. They just loved us and sat with us and cared about us. And some of the best counseling appointments I've ever had as a pastor have been ones where I just listen and have someone come to my office and pour their heart out and then leave saying, "That was a great meeting, Pastor." I said, "Well, I didn't say a word, but
right.
I listened." And I think that's very important in your line of work, to listen and hear the heart behind the hurt.
You are a great listener. How did you get to be that way? Is that something that you feel like you always had in you, or is that something that you worked on?
I think back when I was in radio, which I spent many years in radio, I did a lot of interviews, and I had a thought that interviews, most interviewers have a series of questions written down, and they rattle on the list, and they go from question to question in order that they had prepared it, and it gets very choppy. I had an idea that a good interview was a good conversation that people wanted to listen into. If you're on a streetcar or on a subway, and people next to you are having a really good conversation, you naturally are inclined to listen in and just hear what they're saying. And if you can have a good conversation on the radio or on a podcast and talk about something interesting with interest in it yourself, people are going to want to listen to it. So I found myself listening for the answers to the questions I was asking and forming my next question for the interviewer, for the interviewee, based on the last question I asked and they answered. And I had many people tell me that it was very refreshing. It was a good way to get information into a good conversation and get it into people's ears and into their hearts. But it came naturally after a while to just ask a question and listen to the answer. It's easy enough, but you know as well as I do, people, they do one or two things. I see this as a pastor all the time. People have a conversation with themselves in their head.
Mm-hmm.
And they play it out as a conversation that they'd like to have with a certain so-and-so who's upset them and made them angry. And they're thinking, "I'd like to say this to them, and then I bet they'd say this, and then I'd say this back, and they'd probably get really mad, and they'd probably say this, and they'd probably put it on Facebook." And none of that's happened. It's all in your mind. It's mental energy that doesn't need to be spent. And people either do that, or they ask a question and don't wait for your answer. They just want to be heard, so they just keep asking questions or giving you the answers, and they have their own agenda. And people, as I said it before, unless you show you care, they don't care what you have to offer. And it's why when we run relief efforts, we have to make sure we meet physical needs before we can meet spiritual needs. Because there's an old African proverb, empty bellies have no ears. And we have to be aware of that we have to meet physical needs. And so you have to do the work of running conferences and educating people and reaching out to young people who are struggling. You have to do that in your job. And you have to do it well, because you want them to believe you care. Because if you don't care, you're just another stop on the long list of visits they have to go to counselors and doctors. And but if you can interrupt that and say, "I really care for you and I really care about you."
So true. I just read this really great quote. I wish I could remember the book. I'm so sorry that I can't. I'll put it in the show notes. But the book said, you know, there are often five or six good ways or good plans, you know, to get to this, a certain result. There's five or six good routes, but at the end of the day, the problem is, can you get the people to do the plan? It doesn't matter if you have the best plan in the world if no one's willing to work the plan. And oftentimes, the work the plan part really is built around relationship. I can think of in our coalition, there's been so many times where a coalition member will do something, not because they think the plan is the best plan or it's well thought out or whatever. It's because they have a relationship with the somebody who's asking them to do it, and they really respect and trust that person. And I think we like to skip that part sometimes. We like to skip the relationship building part because, frankly, it's a lot of work. It's tiring. And just because you built a great relationship with somebody doesn't mean that it's going to stay great. It's something that you have to constantly maintain and constantly, you know, nurture and just care for. And I think one of the big struggles in our world is that the relationship building comes really from listening. And I don't necessarily know if we as a society are great listeners. I think it's true. Oftentimes we see a problem and think, here's a solution. And we forget the human component. We forget that it involves people to solve problems. And that involves sitting and listening and building relationship.
You have to realize the human factor, like you just said, that that's very important, because we're trying to change people, but people don't change easily. It's hard to change an addiction. It's hard to change a habit or a pattern in your life. So I encourage people to give it time. We live in an instant society. Everything comes quickly. Fast food, fast channels on your TV that you just zip through. And I remember when I was a kid, you had to wait a whole week for your next episode to be on Flipper or Wild Wild West, or a show that I loved as a kid. But you'd watch it on Thursday night and have to wait till next week at Thursday at 10 o'clock before it came on again. And now they could just sit down and watch a whole series, every episode in a season, and binge on it, and don't have to wait for anything. It's just, we're not used to waiting anymore. But yeah, you have to wait with people, because people just change slowly. And sometimes it takes a long time, a lifetime. We have a friend who I worked with when he was a young child, 8, 10, 12 years old, and I always thought he had gifts and was a very special young man, and he just got out of prison after being in prison for nearly a decade, and he's come around now, and he's just different. He's changed. But it took 25 years, and you have to give yourself the time, folks. You have to be patient, because people don't change easily, and they don't change just because you want them to change. You can't control people, and you can't get mad about it either. I've often found that people, when they try to control other people, it's an impossibility, so they lose control themselves. And they get angry, and they get frustrated. Self-control is very important in dealing with other kinds of control. And if you can't control yourself, you're probably trying to control someone else. So I'll illustrate it by saying we live in an environment, and we perceive our environment as to what it is. And if we don't like something, it bumps against us and it knocks us. And there's another proverb I like that says, "Whatever fills you up spills over when you're bumped." And if you're full of anger and frustration when you get bumped by a young teen that's struggling, or some child that you find incorrigible and just hard to manage and hard to discipline, if you're really frustrated when they bump you, you're going to spill out anger and frustration. But if you're full of peace and patience and kindness and joy and all those good things that we have available to us, have that spill out of your life and hit the other person, it often has an effect that's very positive.
When you're speaking, it reminded me that sometimes too, the changing, we think, oh, this person needs to change, or this community needs to change, they need to change, because we have a set of ideas of how it should look in our own mind. And I found in this work, sometimes it's me that needs to change. In fact, more often than not, it's me that needs to change. And if I'm rushing in with my idea and not sitting just to wait and watch, there have been so many times where the problem really does already, you know, have all the solutions it needs from the community itself. It's not me that needed to add my two cents. And I also think that it's so important to ask questions and hear people out. I was watching this little kids show, because I'm inundated with little kids shows these days, having a 3-year-old and a 4-year-old, and it was a PBS kids show. I think it's called Molly of Denali. But I looked online just to see how they wrote the show, and they talked about in the show they have a board of, I want to say, like 70 advisors who've created this show. The show is set in Alaska and follows one of the native people there, a little girl who lives in one of the villages. And they just began to talk about all the input that the advisors had. One of the pieces that got cut out of the show was they had a scene where they were drying fish next to a basketball court. And one of the folks creating the show said, that's not something we would ever see in our community. You would never dry your food next to a place where you're kicking up dust and playing a game. And I thought, wow, that's just an observation myself I would never have. I don't dry fish. That's not my way of life. But yet how when you involve the people and you sit and listen and even let people write their own story instead of you writing it for them, you capture a story instead, you get a more authentic picture and you also get information out that's really going to be helpful rather than trying to put your solutions and your perspective. And tying that back to Parkinson's and the where you're at, I think it's remarkable that you live every single day with just bringing so much hope to other people. You're one of the people that I would say is the most steadfast person I've ever met. You never give up on people. I've seen people who just, I think they've had 10 million chances and you still give them that next chance, and how just the struggles that you've had, the lens that you see things through, it just has so much grace. And I think one of the things you say all the time is that you've experienced so much of it yourself that you feel, how could you not give that to other people?
Grace is what it's all about. It's something I've tried to learn in my life, and I know it's written down that whatever you use gets measured back onto you, and I believe that. So I think I'm going to need a lot of grace, so I give out a lot of grace. And we're the Church of Second Chances, where I pastor. And I say second chances, third, fourth, fifth, sixth, seventh chances. They don't give up on people because they're too precious, too valuable.
I think that's such an important message, even for right now in our world. I was listening to some parents, and they were just so upset because they were saying with their online schooling that the teachers were giving their kids too much online work, and they're so frustrated. And then I heard from a teacher just saying, you know, this is frustrating for us too. We're experiencing trauma as well. This is so difficult for everyone. And this could be a time in our life where just we as a planet really have the best come forward rather than the worst. And it is true, there have been so many amazing, beautiful stories of people who are really just going above and beyond to just show that grace, just to say, you know, I know this person got angry and upset, but I'm just gonna, you know, give the extra benefit of the doubt and just really be kind to others. It's like we all kind of realize the preciousness of life all over again as a planet, and thinking about the good that comes out of challenge. And even though it's so difficult for you with Parkinson's, you and I have experienced so many beautiful things as well. And it's not to say that both of us don't wish every single day that it was gone. You know, there's never a time where I'm like, yay, I'm so glad this happened because all these good things happened as a result. No, it really does. It's just awful. But I do think it's important to focus on those good things and to have hope and really encourage ourselves every single day and look for the beauty in life.
My wife Amanda, she's very good at what she does, and I'm very proud of her. So thank you for listening. I'm glad to be a part of this today.
To everybody out there, I hope you continue to stay safe and continue to do the great work that you're all doing. It's so important during this time. And always, I think about just the countless lives that are affected by the work that you do. And I just want to say thank you.
Thank you for listening to the Organizing for Change podcast, where our goal is to empower coalitions, organizations, and individuals to bring positive change to their communities. To learn more about us or to get the show notes from today's episode emailed to your inbox, log on to our website. We hope you are inspired by today's show and keep up the great work. See you next time.